Hello and welcome to another episode of Fully Scored, with me, your host, Matthew Frost. On this episode, we navigate a classic Easter meditation as Bandmaster Gavin Lamplough talks us through Morley Calvert's For Our Transgressions. Cast away and abandoned on Arid Island album this month is staff bandsman Nicholas Brill. We dropped in to the island to see which album he'd packed with him and why. But before we venture there, it was a great privilege to chat with Territorial Youth and Children's Secretary and former staff bandsman Jonathan Whitmore, live at the Lighthouse.
Well, Johnny Whitmore, welcome to Fully Scored.
Oh, thank you very much for having me. It's great to be with you, Matt.
Oh, thank you so much for giving up the time to chat to us. And you may notice we're probably both a little bit tired. We're recording at the Lighthouse Theatre just before the TYB and TYC final festival this evening.
Yeah, what a great week it's been, hasn't it?
It's been phenomenal, as always.
Yeah.
But I think we're all a little bit sleep deprived and full of some sort of cold. So apologies to listeners, well, from my side, for sounding so hoarse anyway. Yeah. There's a joke there about a long face, isn't there? But we'll preempt that one. But it was great to speak to you, and we've got a few questions to get to know a little bit about you.
Sure.
Well, we might as well make a start instead of rambling on. So you're here in your capacity and role as the new Territory Youth and Children's Secretary.
Yes.
What does a week like this that you've attended previously as a student mean to you to be here?
Yeah. Well, it's so exciting to be back here at the Territorial Youth Band and Territorial Youth Chorus courses. I think, as you said, I came many years ago as a student. So I attended the very first Territorial Youth Band. I think it was like 24 years ago. It's 1998. 26 years ago, 1998, attended the very first course as a 14-year-old. And had an absolutely brilliant time. It really opened my eyes to the world of Salvation Army music making, really went away encouraged, opened my eyes to a wider Salvation Army, was encouraged in my spirituality, was encouraged in my leadership. So to come back to a week like this, in this role, it's been a real privilege to connect with the young people, to connect with the leaders, to make music together, and there's been some really special moments through the week.
Amazing, and a nice bit of symmetry that some of the repertoire that you played in your very first year is on the programme tonight as well.
Oh yes, yeah, Call of the Righteous, opening the concert tonight, and was on the programme on that very first Territorial Youth Band.
Yeah. Fantastic, that's really exciting. And a little bit later in the interview, we've got some quirky quickfire questions written from the students here at TYB for you.
Oh,
so good luck.
Thank you.
So, in your role, your new role that we mentioned about, what sort of impacts do you see that music and music making has on young people's spiritual journeys?
Yeah, I think that really, for me, I can speak for me, and I've seen it in the other young people this week. I find it a really powerful way to connect with God when I'm making music, when I'm playing. I'm not a man for words, as you might hear on this podcast. I'm not as eloquent as some, but there's a way of connecting with God when I play music that just goes beyond words. And so I've seen that for the young people as they've played this week. Many of them have shared that making music, listening to music, playing music has been a way for them to express their worship to God, or a way where God has spoken to them through music. So I think it's a really powerful tool we've got, a really powerful thing that God's gifted us with, to be able to use art like music to connect with Him.
It's really exciting to hear, and brilliant to hear that impact it's had in your life.
Definitely.
And how you're able to help shape into other young people's lives as well, in the same way. So let's jump back a little bit in history now. So I'm sure that frequent listeners of the podcast will know that you have previously appeared on Fully Scored as Band Mastermind Trivia. Who was the youngest person ever to be appointed to the International Staff Band? It was you.
I believe, yes.
At the age of 16?
Right? I was 16 at the time, and got a phone call and went for an audition at the old headquarters in Queen Victoria Street. And it was great. My dad had to write to the school to ask if I could have a Wednesday afternoon off school to travel down to London to be a part of the band, and that was made possible. And so in January 2000 I joined the band, and it was again, it was a great experience. Some real encouragers in that band, people who just came alongside. Steve, who in my mind took a risk on me as a young lad, really encouraged me. There were players on the section like Steve Yalden who really came alongside me and nurtured me and encouraged me in my playing, and I just had a great time once a month going around and seeing different cores around the United Kingdom, and worshipping with them and seeing what mission and ministry looked like in all those different places around the territory.
Was it quite easy to fit in with a band being that younger generation?
Many of you will know that in the brass band there's lots of fun, there's lots of laughter, so there was all the jokes that when we got on a late night coach they all had to be quiet so Johnny could go to sleep ready for school the next day, or they had to stop band practice halfway through for Johnny's milk break. So there's all those little jokes going around, but I felt very much at home very quickly. The band were really good with me.
Fantastic. And you were part of the band for how long?
About five and a half years I was in the band, and yeah, had some great memories from that time.
What are some of your most cherished memories from those years?
Well, obviously, so some of the Albert Hall festivals were really special and memorable times. At the age of seven, I was taken to my first National Brass Band Championships with my dad, and that's been an annual thing we've tried to do when possible over the years, that I still go to that with dad. And so to play at the Albert Hall in some of those concerts was a really special time. We did a trip to America that started in Canada in 2004 and went through America, and again that was a really special time. I remember some deep connections with God on that tour, as we saw other parts of the world, other parts of the Salvation Army, as we journeyed around. So some great opportunities.
Fantastic. I'd love to know, was it easy to get the time off school?
Well, I don't really know. It was a rage as a 16-year-old. I didn't really get involved in that side of things. I was just told it. Yeah, you know, they said you could, so yeah. Off I went.
How jealous were your friends?
I think I probably had to do... Well, Wednesday afternoon was always games afternoon, sports afternoon, and I've never really been such a sportsman. So, off I went to staff band practice in my school uniform, straight from school.
So if you weren't in the band, then you might be playing for the England football team.
Probably.
Natural. So let's jump back even further, shall we, before your time in the band.
Yeah.
I'd be interested to know where your interest in music began. Was it a sudden thing, or was it a smooth sort of building of interest?
Well, for as long as I can remember, I've been interested in music. And there's pictures, there's a photo I've got of me. My dad was the bandmaster at the small corps in Potton in Bedfordshire, where I grew up. And there's pictures of me sort of just looking at dad playing his euphonium. Or from as long as I remember, I'd have a tambourine or something in the meeting, and when we were singing a song, I'd be hitting it and playing it. And I just always wanted to play percussion and to play the drums. In fact, my first dream, you know, when you start school and they say, what do you want to do when you're older? And my answer apparently was, I wanted to play the drums on top of the horses for the Queen. But I'm allergic to horses, so that didn't happen. But I maintained that love of percussion, that love of drumming. Dad said I had to learn a proper instrument as well. So I also learned the cornet, which you will call a proper instrument as well, won't you?
Certainly would.
Yes. but no, my heart has always been really for drums and percussion. Just captured my imagination.
I didn't realise you were allergic to horses. I shouldn't have made that joke about sounding horse, should I? Sorry. I believe there was one particular album by the ISB that really piqued your interest in Salvation Army banding.
Yeah. I mean, I can probably name a couple. There was a tape that we must have worn out in the car. So about the age of, I can't remember how old I've been, seven, Dad took me along to a Canadian staff band concert in Bedford. And after the concert, I remember they let me go on the stage and hit their tam-tam.
Nice.
Big memory for a seven-year-old at the end of the concert. And we bought their album on cassette tape at Sounds of Joy, and I could sing you the next track before it started. I knew the album so well. But then a few years later, the International Staff Band brought out the Manuscripts album. And again, that was the album that came with the CD-ROM. And before the days of the internet, I would sit and I would read that CD-ROM. I could almost recite you all the parts of the CD-ROM about the different players and the different things the band did, and the different ways they made music, and the different things about each of the personalities in the band, and why they were in the band, and what was special for them about being in a band like the Staff Band.
Amazing. We should definitely put that to the test. Who was a fourth man down on Solo Cornet on that CD?
Ooh, I don't know. Derek Alcock, maybe? I don't know.
Well, I'm sure a listener will let you know. There we go. Fantastic. Mm. That's great to hear. Mm. And after you left school and had that interest in music, you went to study at the Guildhall School of Music and Drama, was it?
Yes, yeah, music and drama, yeah. Yes.
Which did you study?
definitely on the music side. I mean, all my friends said I went and got a degree in hitting things, which is probably quite true. But
caressing
yes.
things.
Well, yeah, so this came up earlier in the week, didn't it? Didn't it, Matthew? You don't just hit a drum, you know, or a triangle. You have to make music out of it. You caress it. You draw the sound out.
It's a quote that you'll never live down that.
No, probably not.
So what was your time like studying at the Guildhall? Did you enjoy getting really into the nitty-gritty of percussion playing?
Definitely, definitely. What I really enjoyed about the course at the Guildhall back then was the variety of music that you got to make, and particularly being a percussionist. So I could be doing African drumming in the morning, and I could be playing a Mahler symphony in the afternoon, and then some jazz or some contemporary music at night. And actually, I really enjoyed that. I enjoyed the variety. I think for me, doing the same thing over and over again is not for me. And I think that's probably one of the appeals of percussion, is that you can be playing lots of different instruments through a concert or through a week like the Territorial Youth Band, and you get to try lots of different skills and make lots of different sounds and bring lots of different colours to the music that's being made.
Amazing. It's great to hear. And where did your journey take you as you left your studies?
Yeah, well, it was about halfway through my time at the Guildhall School of Music that God spoke to me, really, about ministry, about going into ministry in and through the Salvation Army, some kind of full-time ministry. And that percussion and making music would just probably be a hobby for me rather than a career for me. So after studying at the Guildhall, I went and did a Salvation Army gap year. It was called the Timothy Programme back then, and went down to South Wales. And that was a really interesting time for me because the place where I was, Gibbonsdown, didn't have a band. I wasn't known as a Salvation Army musician or anything, and I would just go to church on a Sunday just as me. And that was a really interesting experience for me, learning about my identity away from the musician that I'd grown up being within the Salvation Army, what it meant to be a Christian outside of playing music and making music. And I learned a lot about myself in those years.
And was it difficult to leave a lot of the music making that you were doing, like the staff band, to go and explore that calling further?
I think it was a real challenge. It was a challenge. But I was strongly convicted that that was something that God was calling me onto at that stage in my life, something I needed to do. And so that's what I went and did. And actually, even since that point, it's been a way of trying to work out, well, where does music making fit for me? I find it really helpful expressing my spirituality, my connection with God through making music. So where do I get those opportunities? And sometimes it's just at home with headphones on. Quite often I'll be tapping a pillow or hitting my cutlery on the table or something. But there are other opportunities to make music, and the variety of music, whether it's a worship band or a brass band or all sorts of opportunities to make music, and I just love it. I just love finding those opportunities when they come my way.
Brilliant to hear. Mm. And even more specifically, when did you know that your calling was to go into officership, full-time spiritual leadership in the Salvation Army?
I thought probably at that time when I was in the staff band, there was a calling to officership there, but I also knew it wasn't for then. And so there was stuff I needed to do, to unpack, to grow in, to discover, to learn about myself and others. So I remember my last concert with the staff band, or last engagement with the staff band, was commissioning. And so part of commissioning of officers, part of those meetings, they invite anybody who senses a calling to officership to go forward onto the stage. And I remember doing that then. But it would be many years later before I actually went into the training college.
And when you went in, you were part of the Messengers of the Kingdom session?
Definitely, yes.
And your first appointment, you were sent up to Barrow-in-Furness.
Barrow-in-Furness, yeah, in Cumbria, near the Lake District. So a long way from I've been pretty much a southern boy, really. Bedford, I was born, spent a bit of time in London. But yeah, sort of felt very at home in those areas. So going up to Barrow-in-Furness in Cumbria was a new experience for us. But I loved it up there. I loved the town. I loved the people up there. Great beaches. Very underrated. But a community who really looked out for each other. A community who I just really enjoyed engaging with and getting to know. And then you also had the beauty of God's creation in that part of the world. So chances to go out onto to beaches or to go up into the hills and the lakes and do some walking. I just loved being up there. So it was a great time of ministry, and Kat and I were quite settled up there with our three children. Yeah.
So was it a surprise then to get the call to say, your new appointment, you'll have to move back down to London?
Yes, yeah, it was very much a surprise that we were being asked to move, but actually part of the officership thing for me, and maybe one of the reasons I didn't explore officership earlier, was that letting go of control of where you'd be sent when. And so that was a big part of our call to officership, was to say, actually we trust you, God. We trust the Salvation Army, but more than that, we trust you, God, that you'll place us where you need us. So when the call came and said, Johnny, Kat, we'd like you to take on this role as our Territorial Youth and Children's Officers, yeah, we were really overwhelmed, really, with the feelings of, are we good enough? Can we do this? Is this what we should be doing? It's a big move for our children, all those kind of human feelings and emotions that you go through, but also sensing that word from God that, I'm with you, I've got you, and it'll be okay.
And we're so pleased you're in that role. You've been brilliant this week, and it's great. I'm really excited to see what the future holds for you in this role. Mm-hmm. What is your vision for young people and children around the Territory going forward?
Yeah, well, I think, first of all, I'd want every young person, whether they're engaging with the Salvation Army or outside of the Salvation Army, to experience and to know that God loves them. God loves them deeply, unconditionally, just as they are. And then as they learn that, have relevant ways to express their love for God and express their a calling to love others as well. And so whether that is finding ways to help them to grow deeply in their discipleship with Jesus, their journey of following him and becoming like him, whether it's opportunities to grow in the leaders that God has made them to be. I believe all young people, children and youth, are leaders and are leaders now. Not have the leadership potential, but are leaders now. Some will be quiet influencers. Some will be loud and upfront. But there'll be ways that God will be placing leadership opportunities for them, ways to shape the world around them, ways to grow the kingdom of God. And I just pray that adults and cores around the Territory will be open to hearing the voice of children, young people, and hearing what God is saying and challenging them with. So yeah, there's some of the things that I'm excited about. And actually, it's the great thing about this role is you get to hear some of those stories about what God is doing in and through children and young people up and down our Territory.
Mm. Wonderful. Mm. And just to tie everything together, really, right now in your life, what role does music have in your faith?
So I think as I said earlier, music is a special way for me to connect with God. I almost see it as like a spiritual gift or a special gift that's given, not a gift of playing necessarily, but a gift of connecting with God, either by hearing music or by playing music. There's just something deep that goes on within me in those times. So, yeah, very special for me.
Amazing. And we're going to venture out the more serious side of the podcast now and into uncharted waters.
Oh dear.
With some quirky quickfire questions.
Okay.
As I said earlier, that have been submitted by students here at TYB 2024.
Oh. Well, so, I'm pleased we're hearing the voice of young people, but I'll I might reserve judgment on that till after these questions have been asked.
Absolutely. Good luck.
Thanks.
So, the first of the quirky quickfire questions, this is actually one of my standard ones. Mm. Who's your favourite Salvation Army composer?
Ooh. I quite like a bit of Robert Redhead. Quite like a bit of Peter Graham. So, yeah, probably one of those.
Tussle between the two.
Yes, yep. Yes.
Excellent. And even more specifically, have you got a favourite Salvation Army piece of music?
Well, when I was in the band, I really enjoyed playing Glorifico Eternum by Dean Jones. That was a special piece for me. One that's quickly becoming a favourite is a new piece that we've just played this week, Faith Walk by William Himes, using the chorus, I'm in his hands. So that's also a goodie. But yeah, there's many, many pieces.
Powerful music
to listen to.
Indeed. Yeah. So here we have some of the students' questions. Mm-hmm. First question comes from Hermione. Which Disney princess do you resonate most with?
Good question, Hermione. I think probably Anna from Frozen. She's the one that's not very princess-like, isn't she? She's just quite normal in her princessing.
I have no idea, but we'll take that as a good answer. Next question is from Ellen. What is your favourite brand of bottled water?
Ooh, I'm a tap water guy. I've got my good old trusty reusable water bottle here. So lovely. Tap water for me.
All the way.
Better for the environment as well.
Sponsored by Thames Water.
Yes.
Catherine says, Crocs or trainers?
Ah, Crocs I know are very comfy, but I'm a trainers man.
Nice. So next question comes from George. What is your go-to meal deal from Tesco's?
Ooh, I'm a chicken sandwich. I'd have one of the little innocent smoothies, the strawberry banana one.
Nice.
Yeah, and then either some sort of beefy crisps or a chocolate bar. I like a plain milk chocolate.
Excellent, lovely. And in a similar vein, Molly says, what is your McDonald's order?
It varies. It does vary. I quite like a chicken sandwich, something like that, and a strawberry milkshake, occasionally vanilla.
Very nice indeed. Mm. Caelan asks, what flavour of Mauam would you choose?
Ooh, a nice raspberry Mauam.
Callum says, what is your favourite Corsa colour?
Corsa?
I presume a Vauxhall Corsa.
Oh, a car.
Maybe.
Ooh.
Or you can interpret it how you'd like.
Favourite Corsa colour? A red car. Red. I had a small red Yaris as my first car.
Nice.
I enjoyed that.
Johnny asks, what in your opinion is the correct way to eat a tomato?
Ooh, if it's one of those little mini cherry tomatoes, in one, it's got to be in one.
Jamie asks, if you were to play a TYB member of staff in table tennis, who would you choose to compete against and why?
Ooh, I think I might have to go for the doctor himself, Dr. Cobb. I think he would be mean at a table tennis game.
Absolutely. Strong arm from all that conducting to return your serves.
Whip some spin on them, I'm sure. Oh, come in, Paul. We're just recording a podcast. Do you want to be in?
Well, we've just been joined by Paul Sharman, whose dressing room we've commandeered to record this at the Lighthouse.
Yeah.
Paul, I've got here on my phone a question written by one of the students at TYB. Do you want to read it to Johnny?
Yeah, I'll do that. What's your favourite Paul Sharman composition?
Oh, don't know. Can't think of any. No, I quite like your recent Denmark Hills. Great little xylophone part. Get rhythmic on that.
Yeah, played very well at TMS.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks, Paul. Good to see you.
Thank you. I'll leave you.
You're welcome to stay. What is your favourite radioactive isotope?
Don't have a clue.
That's a great question.
I never really got into chemistry.
Have you got a favourite national anthem?
I quite like Tchaikovsky's 1812 Overture. So the old French national anthem in there.
Nice. Yeah, good. Absolutely. Thank you, Alex, for that question. Here's a really good question from Francesca. What's your favourite percussion beater / stick?
Oh. I think a good yarn mallet. Yeah,
excellent.
A good yarn mallet.
All the percussionists listening will be nodding their heads, I'm sure.
Yeah. Something firm, but not too hard.
No,
yeah.
Absolutely. And finally, a question from Jacob. If pizza toppings were only fruit or vegetables, what three would you choose to go on your dream pizza?
Oh, great question. Well, I remember at uni I made a Brussels sprout pizza. Ooh, that was successful. Yeah. I quite enjoyed it. Quite enjoyed a bit of a Brussels sprout pizza. Fruit or vegetable? I do like a bit of pineapple. Probably not with the Brussels sprout.
That's an acquired taste.
Yes. And another fruit. I don't know. Maybe something exotic like a banana or plantain or something like that. Yeah.
Fantastic. Very nice. Indeed. Well, there are so many good questions that we've had submitted by students. Unfortunately, we can't have them all this time, but maybe at some point in the future they will surface. So thank you to TYB students for sending those in.
Yeah.
And just to round things off, we get to Band Manager 2024. For listeners that may not know the format of this segment, we ask each guest to choose to nominate two players to join our fantasy band. The players can be nominated because of their playing inspiration to you, their spiritual nurturing or musical nurturing in your life. So, Johnny, who would your two nominations be for the Fully Scored Band Manager Band 2024?
Ah, there have been so many great influences on me over the years. I think of Steve Yordan, particularly from a percussionist point of view. Before I joined the band and when I joined the staff band, he was such a great encourager for me. But I understand he was in the band last year. So if I'm going to go for other people, I'd go for my billet partner when I was in the band, Brad Turnbull. Real encourager. We had some great fun driving up and down and going and staying together in various places. Brad, a real encourager for me in those early days, and a great trombone player. So probably that's the second trombone bench filled. I'm trying to think of a second. In terms of spiritual nurture, can we go for an executive officer?
Oh, yes. Let's do it. Yeah.
So, Lieutenant Colonel Ian Barr was an executive officer when I was in the band, and he was a great encourager, and he told some great stories on weekends away, which always had us laughing, but also challenged us greatly. So, yeah.
Fantastic. Two wonderful choices, nominations for the band. Thank you for that, Johnny.
Thank you.
We'll speak to you in a little bit after our analysis to put you to the test in Band Mastermind.
Thank you.
Thanks, Johnny. We'll hear from you a little bit later in Band Mastermind. Now it's time to reflect on the message of Easter, as we're joined by Gavin Lamplough, who's going to guide us through Morley Calvert's For Our Transgressions.
Gavin, thank you so much for joining us once again on Fully Scored. I can't believe it, but it's been about 20 episodes since we last heard from you, so it's great to hear your voice again.
Thank you, Matthew. It's great to be back. Obviously, this time with a slightly different emphasis, getting to look at some really important repertoire in the Salvation Army vast library of music that exists for brass bands, and it's just a great delight to be back here doing this.
And as you've alluded to, we're going to be looking at and doing an analysis for us today of Morley Calvert's Easter Meditation For Our Transgressions. Before we chat about the actual music itself, could you give us a little bit of context into the life and influence of Morley Calvert?
Yes, it was being quite a joy to look into a little bit more of Morley Calvert's life, as well as looking into this music itself. And one thing that struck me is, if you've ever wondered who might be the most frequently performed Canadian composer outside of that vast country, it's most likely Morley Calvert. Keith Kinder, whose reputation was made as a music professor at the McMaster University, wrote quite an in-depth study of Morley Calvert, and he said in that Calvert had written as many as 90 works during his lifetime, and he may be the most frequently performed Canadian composer outside of the country. But whether that bold claim is validated or not, I do think that it endorses the fact that Morley Calvert's reputation as a composer extends beyond what we know within the Salvation Army. Kinder goes on to say in his book, which is called The Musical Life of Morley Calvert, he says this: Calvert's compositional output encompasses many genres, but overall is characterised by one common element. Virtually all was written for a particular event, group, or purpose. Above all, Calvert was a practical musician. He composed for his own groups, for ensembles with which he was associated, or on commission. Although these constrictions limited what he could create, he demonstrated a great deal of imagination in writing within them.
Fantastic.
So the book goes on to say that Calvert's harmonic practice remained largely within the confines of tonality, and I think we would certainly be able to confirm that from the music that we know of his. Although he did want to stretch the boundaries of the tonal system into the expanded tonality of the 20th century. So he certainly wasn't a man to rest on his laurels, to kind of make his music predictable in any way. It does seem as though a lot of his experimentation, if we want to call it that, included the use of non-functional harmonies, modality, polytonality, even tetrachords of varying intensity and dissonance. But he was certainly a pragmatic writer. That's pretty much clear.
Great stuff.
And it was argued within this book that Morley Calvert, probably alongside Howard Cable, one of the first Canadian composers to gain widespread success with his works for band, was probably right up there as the most significant of Canadian composers.
It's really fascinating to hear. I'd never thought that Calvert could be one of the most performed musicians outside of Canada from that country. That is really interesting. So when we speak about Morley Calvert's life, what sort of era and dates are we talking about?
Okay, so he was born in Ontario in June 1928. Morley then moved to Montreal with his family in 1930 because his father was transferred with work. So, of course, the whole family went there. And it was there that the young Morley Calvert grew up, and then later pursued much of his professional career. It would appear that music came quite naturally to Morley Calvert. His parents were Salvationists and actively involved in the busy music program at their church. His father, Thomas Calvert, who incidentally was often known as Fred, quite where they got that from, I don't know. But yes, Fred Calvert, or Thomas Calvert, was an outstanding euphonium player. And his mother, Margaret, sang with the songsters. However, music in the family had a much longer history than that. Fred's father, Morley Calvert's grandfather, was a noted musician who served for a time as the bandmaster at the Peterborough and then later the Oshawa Temple Corps. It does appear, certainly, that Morley was exceptionally talented. He was blessed with perfect pitch.
Nice.
And had an extraordinary musical memory. Like many of us, of course, began playing the cornet at the Salvation Army Church. He was about 8 years old. And he was playing with the Montreal Citadel Senior Band, probably around age 11 or 12. So he was clearly a very mature player, although the reason why he was playing with the band so young was probably because of other band members being enlisted and deployed during the war. But he joined formally, age 14, and regularly attended the Salvation Army's summer camp at Jackson's Point. And one of his earliest compositions, actually, was a piano piece called Memories of Jackson's Point. So it obviously had quite a profound effect on him, something I'm sure that we can and our listeners can testify to, those who have been to those Salvation Army summer camps. They do make a lasting impression and really inspire young Salvationist musicians on their way. But then came a more formal music education. He had piano lessons with another very famous Salvation Army name, Norman Audouard, the composer of Montreal Citadel. And that study also included a licentiate of the Royal Schools of Music. He got that in 1948. And then he became an associate in music from the McGill University in Montreal, and then studied for a Bachelor of Music degree, again from McGill. And perhaps for those of us who aren't from North America, it's probably worth saying that the McGill University is a really prestigious university, often referred to as the Harvard of Canada. So he clearly was a very bright gentleman, as well as an outstanding musician.
And for those that aren't from North America, Harvard's often referred to as the McGill of North America.
Quite possibly.
Yeah.
So alongside that prestigious education, presumably Calvert had quite an active role at the court?
Yes. At the Montreal Citadel, he became the songster leader before taking over as the bandmaster for a whole decade between 1960 and 1970. Morley Calvert left Montreal in 1969 to do a master's qualification in London, UK. Now, whilst in London, I do know that Morley Calvert had something in common with both you and I in that he played for the ISB for just the year, but he did play with the ISB.
Fantastic. Really fascinating to hear some of that background in the life of a composer that I guess, well, I certainly didn't know that much about. So thank you for doing that research and enlightening us all with that. So let's talk about his music. What is it about Calvert's compositions that make them so unique?
Well, I think it's fair to say that the music of his that I've listened to in recent weeks whilst preparing for this, they're mostly light and quite pleasing works. I think it's fair to say that much of his compositional work presents modest to little technical demand to achieve what he was looking for. They're very playable and often orchestrated quite lightly, always very graceful, kind of like a chamber-like accompaniment. Many of his works, it would appear, do include folk songs. He clearly had a passion for very strong tunes, very old tunes, and I guess it's very accessible due to the many folk-like melodies that he employs. When I looked a little closer at some of his compositions, it does reveal certain fingerprints, as it does for most composers, and probably a preferred way of working. His approach to tonality, for example, involves lots of major and minor sevenths, and lots of added note chords as well. He seems to use the diminished seventh chord a lot, and much like the great Wagner, he seemed to prefer the sound of a half-diminished chord, series of minor thirds with the exception of a major third between the third and fourth notes. So he certainly did have his fingerprints, the things that he went back to time and time again, the things that worked for him. There are many other added notes that he often used to give his harmonies that kind of rather distinctive flavour. But I'd say that it's probably Morley Calvert's devotional work for our transgressions, which for me illustrates, yes, his compositional fingerprints, but also the depth of his spiritual experience, as well as it just being, as I say, purely an outstanding piece of writing.
So where about in Calvert's writing an output would this piece fall?
Okay, so I've got a rather beaten-up score from the Birmingham Citadel Band Library, and the date on the front of this is March 1957. So this was written before Morley became bandmaster at Montreal Citadel, but I would suggest that it was likely written for Montreal Citadel Band, given his characteristic of often writing for groups that he was associated with. It was actually the third devotional work of his that the UK Music Editorial Board had published, and this was by some way the most developed, large-scale, almost programmatic work of the three that had been published to this point. Ray Steadman Allen wrote the programme notes in the score, and as I flick through these, he certainly reflected that the music was deeply emotional, he uses those words, and that the craftsmanship displayed in the handling of the material was mature and assured. So if the great RSA rated him, I guess he must be doing okay. So obviously when we look at the inspiration for this work, it's clearly scripture, and clearly the title of this work comes directly from verse 5 of the 53rd chapter of Isaiah, where it says, "He was wounded for our transgressions, he was bruised for our iniquities. The chastisement of our peace was upon him, and with his stripes we are healed."
And without further ado, let's delve into the score itself and look through the music, shall we?
Yeah. We start with the introduction, where Morley Calvert starts with a motif that is taken from the chorus, "Out of his wounded side." This motif is transformed into an imitative figure, as the fragment of this tune is passed between the flugel and solo horn as a pair, and then onto the baritones and euphoniums, and then the cornets. Notice how the motif is treated, first of all in unison, before being harmonised, exploring it in different registers, different timbres, and also towards the end, diminution of that motif as we move towards the end of the introduction. And that provides an intensity in the music as we head to the agitato at letter A. Now, at letter A, we hear what RSA calls the motto theme for the whole work. It's kind of like that one motif that is present throughout. It's firstly presented in the solo cornet line. Now, the reason he calls it so is because from this point onwards, there is not a single page of the score where the motif does not occur in some way, shape, or form. Themes and motifs have always been used as glue in music. It's been the case for centuries. It wasn't new then, and it's certainly not new now. And any sophisticated work will almost certainly have these unifying themes. It's the conductor's job, of course, to try and bring these out of the texture and to allow the frequent appearances to fuse the music through familiarity of themes for the listener. So we now move to letter B, and this is the first of the four featured hymns out of his wounded side. Now, the tune itself is presented in a way that stays faithful to the original Sidney Cox song, but it is accompanied by the motto theme that we've just spoken about, and it's been reinforced in the solo cornet and also the euphonium. Here we see Calvert's trademark clear and light scoring that resembles the scoring of chamber music. The score is really uncluttered, and much like in chamber music, most of the instruments get their moment in the sun to play a melody or a counter melody or something of interest. Even if we look at the eighth bar of letter B, the tubas having their treatment of the motto theme, so everyone gets their opportunity to shine.
And that takes us into letter C.
Yeah, letter C, probably more of a transitionary section, I would say, at letter C. And so Calvert returns to his motto theme. We hear an adapted version of this motif in the euphoniums, and it's then developed further as it moves around the band, first cornet, flugelhorn, baritones, basses, they all have it, and other instruments besides. Emerging from this motivic development is the reference to the second hymn, and the second hymn is Life for a Look. Whilst not accented in any way, and certainly still at a mezzo-piano dynamic, for me this melody should probably emerge from the emotional and passionate motto theme with an ever-increasing insistence. It is almost as though we are kind of there at the foot of the cross, watching and being encouraged to consider looking upon Christ's sacrifice and being saved at that very moment as each successive repetition of the phrase is played louder and higher in pitch. There's a real intensity here. This momentary intense and impassioned section subsides, and we return to the tenderness of the hymn, Life for a Look at Letter D. And there is little deviation away from what we would have heard from a song accompaniment in church on a Sunday morning. We assume that the intended verse here is verse 1. It doesn't tell us that, but it would seem to make sense. And the words associated with verse 1 are, there is life for a look at the crucified one. There's a life at this moment for thee. Then look, sinner, look unto him and be saved, unto him who was nailed to a tree. Now, although there is a great challenge to be found in some of the other verses of this song, either way, the words associated with this melody really make this moment in the piece very personal, and the intimate setting with no complex scoring only adds to the poignancy and the directness of this message.
So as we get to letter E, where are we in the structure of this song?
So we've had the verse at letter D, and letter E is the chorus of Life for a Look. We see a return of the motto theme, but I personally, and it is my choice, always like to build a slight accelerando here. For me, the repetition of the words in the chorus, look, look, look and live, that repetition of the word look, suggests an urgency as we are being encouraged to look at Jesus and his sacrifice and accept his grace. Now, it seems to work fairly well to have that sense of urgency in the music, to reflect the perceived urgency in the words, before we then settle back into the gentle presentation from bar 3 of letter E. We never quite finish the chorus of Life for a Look before we are interrupted by the emotional motto theme. And we've seen this in other iconic pieces of Salvation Army music literature. We think of pieces like The Present Age, Deny Thee Never. And we never actually hear the word never, because at that moment in the piece, the person can't quite bring himself to say that word. And here, perhaps we've got a person stood metaphorically at the foot of the cross, considering the sacrifice of what it means to them, and perhaps finds it all just too much to bear, breaks away from the chorus, unable to commit to that final line. Is this gift of grace really for me? I guess we've all kind of been there at some point. And the emotion takes hold, and it's once again portrayed through the motto theme which we hear. And this extended period of passion and urgency subsides once more as we approach letter F, almost as though the person regains composure, signalled by the three accented notes in open fifths in the trombones and the basses.
So that takes us, as you said, to letter F.
This seems like, to me, a series of questions. We hear reference to the words, there is life for a look at the crucified one, but we never complete the line. The phrase is interrupted by a chromatic shift that brings about a sense of questioning. You know, is there really something in this sacrifice for me? It's almost as though the preacher, or the one challenging our character, is saying, I've laid it all out and I've pleaded with you. Now, will you choose to believe and accept? And following this, there is agitation in the writing, with brief references to a number of the chosen hymns, as well as an increase in the tempo and the pitch and the dynamics. And before it is brought to an abrupt end with a general pause, like absolute silence, which is a brave move in itself. And for me, that's the hesitation. Our person has been stopped in their tracks. This is a huge moment for them. And it's followed by an awakening of three notes at pianissimo, perhaps the realization, one might say. Now, letter G, and certainly the Anacrusis into letter G, is a burst of anguish and pain. We've gone from the silence and the three pianissimo notes to three notes at fortissimo and all accented. The marking on Gossier means just that, with anxiety, with anguish, and with grief. This could be continuing the narrative of the person before the cross, or perhaps could reflect the pain and anguish of the crucifixion itself, or indeed could even further depict the words of the prophet Isaiah in Isaiah 53, chapter 4, "Surely he has borne our griefs and carried our sorrows." Each three of those, for me, legitimately could be a reason why Morley Calvert has written the music this way. There is significant chromatic movement here to heighten the anguish, as well as some false relation as well. You'll see we've got concert E flats in the basses, clashing with E naturals in the euphonium and trombone. So again, here's that fingerprint that we were talking about earlier on. Morley Calvert isn't afraid to expand the harmonic language within his music, even what could be perceived as quite functional music for Salvation Army groups that he knows well. He still has that fingerprint of pushing back boundaries. The agitation then subsides, and that's reflected in volume, in pace, in harmony as well. And like ripples in a pond, the tension slowly dissolves through a descending sequence, a very controlled diminuendo, and, as I say, the slowing of the tempo.
So that takes us to letter H in the music.
The music kind of comes to rest in the most tranquil of ways, really, letter H. We have a calming presentation of just the chorus to "The Wounds of Christ Are Open." And once again, Morley Calvert adopts a simple approach to scoring, characteristically, which again brings an air of sincerity, personal prayer, perhaps, to the chorus that's being used. The words are, "The wounds of Christ are open. Sinner, they were made for thee. The wounds of Christ are open. There for refuge flee." And the descending chromatic bass line just further adds a sense of coming to the realization of Christ's sacrifice, as well as adding to the sense of grief and sorrow. And then we come to letter I. In letter I, Morley Calvert continues with his reiteration that the wounds of Christ were made for you and I. But he develops the scoring and he adds a counter melody this time in the form of the final of the four hymns used in this work. It's a very different setting of "I Shall Know Him." The original hymn was often played with quite a bright tempo and a bit of a bounce to it. But Calvert uses a much more reflective setting, and he uses it as a counter melody, which is really clever and inspired that he was able to spot its qualities as a counter melody rather than the kind of main event. And he uses it as that counter melody to the repetition of "The wounds of Christ are open." It is scored in terms of the harmony in the cornets and horn, and it once again makes this a moment of intense personal testimony as the individual is in dialogue with the reiteration of the wounds of Christ are open and the realization of I shall know him, I shall know him, when redeemed by his side I shall stand. I shall know him, I shall know him, by the print of the nails, and it should go on to say, on his hands. But we never finish that final sentence. And perhaps this is the most poignant moment in this work, the realization, perhaps, of just what Christ did for us. The break from the phrase is on the word nails. And those two notes associated with that word nails are repeated twice, with nails almost being sighed, reflecting the extent of the sorrow and the brutality of the crucifixion. The motto theme, that's still there, it always is, in the texture, this time in the euphonium, kind of unifying the work at its very conclusion. And then finally, we come to letter J. As the music draws to a close, we hear a further reference to the tune Out of His Wounded Side, the song that we hear at the very beginning of the work, ending in a very similar way to which it began. There are still moments of tension in the score. We see the chromatic upward move in bar 2 of letter J being an example of this. Which ensures that the emotion remains in the music right to the very end. And there's also a clever use of the first bar of the melody associated with Out of His Wounded Side, as we are almost reminded by several sections of the band that what this music is really about. God's love and God's grace for us all through the ultimate sacrifice in Christ's sacrifice.
Thank you so much, Gavin, for unpacking that music and for giving us some context into the music, but also really revealing the poignancy behind the melodies and the words associated with that music. So appropriate for this time, just after Easter. One final question for you. Is there any particular recording or performance that of this work that you've been involved in, or maybe even not involved in, that means something personally to you?
Yeah, and as I say, we recorded this quite early on in my tenure as bandmaster with the Birmingham City Little Band. I don't suggest for one moment that it's a definitive recording to stand up alongside some of the other greats that are no doubt out there. But for me personally, that would be a highlight. It's my core band that I've been a part of for a number of years, whether as a player or more recently as its conductor. But that was a very special time, and I think that the band really grasped something of the ministry within the music, as well as actually giving a pretty decent reading of the music itself as well. Purely from a musical level, you know, this guy is a very, very gifted musician and an outstanding writer, and that's evidenced through this music. But as I said earlier, what's also very, very clear is his Christian message and testimony coming through the music. His faith is always, always very clear, and the way in which he's able to communicate that through his musicianship is really a wonder to behold, and for me makes this piece stand up alongside the very best of Salvation Army music over the years.
And listeners may be interested to know that that recording you mentioned is what we've used as our musical excerpts in this recording as well.
Wonderful.
Thank you, Gavin, so much for giving up your time to speak and for all the preparation that went into that analysis. Hope to hear from you again soon. Ah, I feel the fresh sea air in my lungs and the sea breeze coursing through my hair. What remains of it? We must be close to Arid Island.
Land ahoy!
Welcome to Arid Island.
Well, Nicholas Brill, thank you so much for joining us on Arid Island. I'm sure that the weather here is not too dissimilar to your home of South Wales.
Yeah, absolutely, Matthew. So the sun is always shining in South Wales.
Fabulous. Excellent. Well, it's we've heard from you once before on the podcast on our Superfan special a good couple of years ago. But now we're going to get to know you a little bit better and, of course, your album choice. But we'll come on to that shortly. So, Nick, tell us a little bit about yourself and where your passion for brass banding, specifically Salvation Army brass banding, came from.
Well, I suppose it came from being brought up in the Salvation Army and having access to a lot of CD recordings from a young age, and then going to a lot of army events. In fact, my first event that I can recall was when I was 6 years old, back in 1994, when my parents took me to the Bandmaster and Songster Leaders Councils at the Albert Hall. From what I recall, it was, of course, the ISB and the ISS, as well as the visiting sections of the German Staff Band and the Sydney Staff Songsters. The big piece that night by the ISB was Corpus Christi, so that's probably one of my earliest memories of, you know, big Salvation Army banding events.
And you're now the Assistant Principal Cornet in the International Staff Band. How long have you been part of the band for?
Well, I've had two stints in the band. One was just after the incredible event ISB 120 in 2011, where I was in for 3 months. But unfortunately, I was starting a new job. I had to leave the band temporarily. But luckily enough, in September 2013, I was able to rejoin the band. So I think in total, I'm just over the 10-year mark as far as membership of the band is concerned.
And a difficult question, but have you got any highlights from your time in the band so far?
Probably. I mean, 2015 was a big year for the band. We were involved heavily in the Boundless Congress, as well as going on tour to Australia. So those two events in the same year were probably the highlights so far. But I mean, every time we go out with the band, and particularly on a Sunday morning, you know, the music we play on a Sunday morning in the meetings, that's always a highlight. So, yeah, two big highlights, and obviously the ongoing highlight of our Sunday ministry.
Fabulous. And away from brass banding, you're quite a keen cricketer and do quite a bit of umpiring.
Yeah, that's right. So I've moved from being a mediocre cricketer as a player when I was in school, and then when I played for a local club, and fortunately enough, one of the things I was able to do during all the lockdowns was go through the qualifications to become an umpire, and I've been doing that for the last 4 years. And this coming season, I'll be actually umpiring in what they call the South Wales Premier League, which is the highest level of recreational cricket in South Wales. So really looking forward to that.
Fantastic. Congratulations on all that hard work that you put in to get there. So, of course, you'll have noticed the Arid Island has its own boundary, the sea. And one other object on the island that you may have taken with you is an album of some description. Before you set off on your journey, you were allowed to take one CD, record, cassette with you. What did you choose to take with you and why?
Well, before I give you the one that I actually chose, I'd just like to share some of the ones that I considered. As I mentioned earlier on, you know, I had access to a lot of CD recordings growing up. And of course, most of those would have been the ISB. I think in particular, the ones in the 90s, Partita, the original manuscripts. Of course, been fortunate now to play on the follow-up with the band. Then some a bit later on, Glory Glory, Jubilee and Origins. I think they've been mentioned on previous podcasts as people's favourites. Then there's the Canadian Staff Band, who I really enjoyed listening to when I was younger. One in particular was the recording Sounds of Joy. And then ones which sort of brought to my recollection were ones my grandfather shared with me when he used to take me back and forth to school. It was the re-released Regal Xenophone collection. I think there were four volumes, so that's where I got introduced to pieces like Sunbeam, Army of the Brave, The Old Wells, Wondrous Day, King of Kings, etc. There's so many good old Army pieces on those recordings. You know, that's where I was introduced from listening to them. And then from a corner player's perspective, one of the recordings I used to listen to all the time was I Hear the Music, which was David Doe's recording with Enfield Citadel Band. I know I played that to death. But what I have done, and this is probably a left field choice, and not many people would think that I would go for this, is a CD which I can recall even from a very early age, listening to over and over again, and that's Music for Children of All Ages by the Chicago Staff Band. Now, the reason why I chose that is because the title is very apt, and it is music which, you know, suits people from a very young age to, you know, older age. Some of the titles featured on there, it opens up with a march by my fellow countryman Ivor Bazanko entitled Rocky Mountain Centennial, which is in the American Festival series. There's also Peggy Thomas playing Jubilance, a solo which I've been privileged to play, particularly during my time at Music College. I use it as one of my recital pieces. And of course, probably the piece that captured my imagination as a very young corner player and bandsman is Jericho Revisited, which is the live recording from the Bandmasters Council in 1987, of which Chicago Staff Band took part, with Major Stephen Harper giving the narration. And I can remember listening to that over and over again. So, you know, just for the influence from that very young age, that's why I've chosen this album.
Fabulous. Well, there you have it. A great album choice, and nice to hear something that we haven't heard mentioned before as well. But thank you so much, Nick, for joining us on the island. I hope you enjoy your stay. Thanks, Nick, for your time and album choice. Now it's your time to get involved. Last episode, we introduced a new Sparsely Scored excerpt. As yet, the crown is unclaimed. So here is that excerpt again, but with an additional band part added. Here's another listen. If you can identify the piece, drop us a direct message to claim victory. Talking of claiming victory, could we have a new leader on the Band Mastermind Fully Scored board today? Let's find out as Johnny Whitmore joins us once again.
Well, Johnny, welcome back. And how is the band mastermind hot seat treating you?
I don't really work very well under pressure, but we'll see how it goes.
Is there a target score that you'd like to beat?
No, just happy to get a few right and to be challenged. Let's see what happens.
So for those that don't know what Band Mastermind is, you have 1 minute and 30 seconds to answer as many brass band trivia questions correctly as you can.
Yeah. So hopefully there's some percussion-based ones in there.
It's luck of the draw. They will come out of a long, long list. So
right, we'll see how it goes.
You do look terrified. I'm really sorry about this. So, Jonathan Whitmore, are you ready to play Band Mastermind?
Yes.
Your time starts now. What is the first piece published in the Noel Jones Music Journal series?
Don't know. It's new?
It's a good guess. We'll come back to the answers at the end. Name the Eric Ball meditation that features the tune It Is Well With My Soul.
Serenity.
Correct. What is the title given to the Martin Cordner work, named after the scientific term for the speed at which a body overcomes the gravitational pull of another body?
Terminal velocity?
You are so close, I'm going to give you half a mark for that. Who transcribed The Light of the World for its smaller scoring publication in the Essay Classics series?
Transcribed it. Andrew Blythe?
Incorrect, I'm afraid. Morley Calvert's Overture to a Joyous Occasion is published in which publication series?
Festival series.
Incorrect. We'll move on. According to the SA Music Index, how many pieces are published in all SA journals with the label Overture?
Ooh, good question. 21?
Oh, you're very close, but incorrect. Which composer has the most pieces published in the Green Favourites book?
Ray Steben Allen?
Correct. What was the last piece of music to be played at the ISB 120 concert?
Call of the Righteous?
It's close, but it's not correct, I'm afraid. What is the translation of Laudate Dominum?
Ooh, don't know, sorry.
Okay. What piece is number 522 in the Unity series? The timer is buzzing, but you've answered, started the question, so you can finish.
522 in the Unity series. Righteousness, Peace and Joy.
It's not, I'm afraid. Let's go. Well, that gives you a score of 2.5.
Okay.
Which isn't a bad score for Band Mastermind at all. We'll just go through the answers. Mm-hmm. So the first piece that was published in the Noel Jones Music Journal series in Australia is He Lives by Noel Jones. You were so close when you said Terminal Velocity. Mm-hmm. The piece is Escape Velocity by Martin Cordner. So we'll give you half for that. Who transcribed The Light of the World for the SA Classic series? It's Michael Babb. And Morley Calvert's Overture to a Joyous Occasion is published in the Maple Leaf Brass publication. Okay. Now, you answered that there are 21 overtures published in all SA Music journals. There are 25.
Ooh.
So, pretty close. Yeah. And the last piece played at the ISB 120 concert was St. Clement's. Andrew Blythe's transcription or arrangement. The translation of Laudate Dominum is Praise the Lord. And finally, number 522 in the Unity series is The Rescuers by Henry Headley.
He gave
me that.
Given me that question. Yes.
There we go.
It's a little much then.
Well, Johnny, thank you so much for giving your time to join us on the podcast today. It's been brilliant to hear you a little bit about your history in the band, but also your passion and your love for the work that you do and the music in general. So thank you for joining us.
No, thank you for the invite. I've really enjoyed it.
Thank you again for joining us, Johnny, and giving up a little bit of time during such a busy and full-on week that we had at TYB. It really was a privilege to speak to you, and a pleasure too. Well, the sun is just about set on this episode, but before we're plunged into total darkness, it's time for a few thanks. Thank you to our terrific trio of guests, Johnny, Gav and Nick, for your time, expertise and encouragement in the words that you've shared. Thank you to our producer, Simon Gash, for much like a primary school project, cutting and pritt-sticking this episode together into a kaleidoscopic collage. Thank you to the shimmering reflection of the moon on the surface of a placid lake. That is the band nerds for the Band Mastermind trivia. And of course, a hearty thanks goes to you, our listener. Hurrah for your ears' attendance today.
much appreciated. See you next time. Goodbye and God bless.